Good afternoon. Our council ready? Please proceed.
Please, the court. This is an appeal by the plaintiff, from the plaintiff below, concerning the granting of motion dismissed by the defendant because of the apparent or the argued failure to comply with the statutory requirements to toll the statute of limitations. To me, a primary question that has to be answered is whether the statute of limitation in this case is an affirmative defense or whether it is jurisdictional.
And from the court's perspective, the primary issue here is whether this is interlocutory. So would you address that?
All right. To me, there was a final judgment. The matter was dismissed as to this defendant, and it was a final judgment as to this defendant.
Okay. Let me quote for you and at least give you the opportunity to comment. This is from Lightburn versus Delaware Power and Light, 158 A2nd 919. It is clear that the order below is not a final judgment, a common law, a judgment dismissing the action against one of several defendants jointly liable was not a final judgment. And that was decided by this court in 1960.
Okay, I have not reviewed that case. The first time that this matter was argued, it was suggested this was an interlocutory appeal, was in the defendant appellee's answering brief. Normally, when I've seen arguments on a locutory appeal, it's made before the briefing has even started by motion.
Right.
And to me, that was a defense that might have been waived at this point. By this point, if it is an interlocutory appeal by this court decision, if what Your Honor reads is correct, then the matter is premature, and we just go back and wait to see what happens to the other defendant. I can tell the court that
is the other defendant an alleged joint tortfeasor?
The other defendant, there were three defendants in the original suit. One I dismissed because I couldn't find an expert. The expert witness was not appropriate. The remaining defendant is Christiana Hospital. There is a factual issue as to whether or not Dr. Greenspun was an agent and employee of Christiana. Christiana has filed a similar motion to this defendant's, which was stayed pending the resolution of this appeal.
What do you mean a similar motion? Based upon service?
By service by Federal Express rather than by certified mail. So, I mean, if the court declines to hear this based on interlocutory appeal, I assume we would go back. Judge Tolliver probably would issue the same decision to Christiana Hospital, and we'd be back here at some future date.
Well, is there also an issue with Christiana Hospital as to whether it actually was received by the...
They have never disputed. In their moving papers, they have not disputed the receipt of it.
Whereas in this case, Dr. Greenspun has disputed the receipt of it.
To me, that's a factual dispute. You have a signed receipt.
Not signed by him.
No, but you would have the same problem. If the notice had been sent by a certified mail and A. Miles had signed for the certified letter, you'd have the same issue here. And I think.
Well, no, because as I understand the facts here, you have not only did you not use certified mail, but you also did not get the address correct, correct? Is that accurate?
There was a typographical error on the letter that was sent to 500 West 14th Street. The delivery was made to 501 West 14th Street.
But the address that was given to FedEx was the wrong address, correct?
By one digit, yes.
So.
But the receipt, if the fact that the address is wrong by one digit, I don't think affects if the receipt is if it's actually received.
Right, but he's claiming that he did not receive it.
And I think that's a factual dispute I was not given a chance to address. We don't know who A. Miles is. We don't know if that's a secretary in his office or a receptionist at the front of the hospital.
Well, arguably, if you follow what the statute prescribes, and then the defendant says, well, you may have sent it by certified mail, but I never got it.
And if there's a signed card receipt, that creates a rebuttable presumption.
Then arguably it wouldn't matter whether the defendant actually received it or not because you complied with the statute and therefore you get the benefit of the extra 90 days. But here you didn't comply with the statute and the defendant says, I didn't even receive it. Doesn't that have a different element to it than just, well, if I'd done it by certified mail, it would have been okay?
We haven't been able to test why the defendant didn't receive it. If A. Miles is a secretary in his office and signed for it, then threw it in the trash can. Right now, there's nothing in the record that says he didn't get it except the defendant's assertion.
What I'm trying to get at is this. Why should this court or the trial court even reach the issue of whether FedEx delivery is sufficient when the statute calls for certified mail, when on top of that, there's a dispute as to whether it was actually delivered. In other words, it's one thing if you say, well, I did use a different form of delivery, but it's clear that the defendant got notice. There's no question about that. Then arguably, one would say, maybe no harm, no foul. But here you didn't use the specified method, and there's a dispute as to whether there was actual notice given.
That's a factual dispute, Your Honor. That
I know it is.
And I think before, if that is the basis that the court is considering the approving the dismissal, I think I should be given the opportunity, as I requested in my brief, to test that factually to find out who A. Miles was. If that was his secretary, I don't think then that's his agent, and he can't say I didn't receive it.
Did you ask for discovery on this issue?
The motion was filed rather than an answer. There was no answer filed in this matter. It went right to the motion to dismiss.
So the answer is no?
No. My recollection is during the oral argument with Judge Tolliver, I said, Your Honor, we don't know whether he received it or not. The only thing we had, there's nothing in the moving papers that say it. There's no affidavit or anything from Dr. Greenspan saying whether he did or didn't get it. The only thing we have, and I don't challenge the counsel's veracity, but all we have is the counsel's statement in moving papers that he didn't receive it. So I believe there's clearly, if he's maintaining he didn't receive it, there's a factual issue that has to be resolved.
Mr. Aber, are you familiar with Rule 54B of the Superior Court Rules?
I'm probably familiar with it in context, but not by number.
Well, let me quote part of it to you. It says, when more than one claim for relief is presented in an action, whether it's a claim, counterclaim, cross-claim, or third-party claim, the court may direct the entry of a final judgment upon one or more, but fewer than all of the claims or parties, only upon an express determination that there is not just reason for delay and upon an express direction for the entry of judgment.
I am familiar with
it. Was a Rule 54B motion made, that is, a motion asking the Superior Court to direct the entry of final judgment in accordance with the rule?
That was, I viewed it as a final judgment. I guess I did not focus on whether or not there were cross other defendants in the matter.
The answer is you did not.
I did not take
you
it.
You didn't proceed in accordance with Rule 54B.
I didn't realize it was necessary at that point.
Okay. To mix, although I don't have before me what Rule 54B said in 1960, the next sentence in Lightburn, from what I read to you earlier, is Rule 54B does not in itself make such an order a final judgment.
I don't want to settle that dispute, Your Honor. If there had been a motion to dismiss this appeal as interlocutory based upon it not being a final judgment, I probably would have acquiesced in it at that time and said, okay, we'll go back and let Christiana have its papers, and then we'll be back up here on a final judgment. It wasn't raised until the defendant's answering brief at that point. So at that point, I figured I had to continue with the briefing of the matter. If I can turn to the issue, Federal Express issue. I do, as I said, I believe that this is an affirmed defense. It's not jurisdictional. The cases that I cite state that where delivery is required by registered mail and the court has dismissed it, it is cases dealing with the long-arm statute, and the court says, this court has said that the trial court doesn't even acquire jurisdiction over the defendant unless the statute is met. That's not the situation in this case. The cases cited by the defendant, Riggs and I think it's Mary in initials, deal with the court's jurisdiction to hear an appeal. In Riggs, there was an appeal from family court, I think, or maybe Mario, and they did not file the appeal bond. So by the time the appeal bond was filed, the time for the appeal had lapsed, and therefore the court said the limitations period was jurisdictional, but the court never acquired jurisdiction. In this case, the law, I think, is fairly clear that the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense that can be waived, and that's what the Cheswold case says.
Well, but this defendant didn't waive it, did he?
He did not waive it, but that's what my argument is, that the means of delivery is not a jurisdictional requirement for the court to acquire jurisdiction. is a part of the affirmative defense. Therefore, we're talking about notice and not jurisdiction. And that's where my argument is, that Federal Express notice is where it's received is the same as certified notice. I'd also suggest to Your Honor is that the case I cited in my reply brief, Marshall versus Ortega, is almost directly on point under a similar statute in Ohio, and there the court said that the time period allowed by that statute was remedial. If you look at the statute synopsis that I cited in my opening brief, I believe, the synopsis of the statute enacted states that very thing, that the 90-day period is to relieve the parties from the burden of the statute of limitations. If the statute is remedial, then the case law of this state is quite clear that it has to be given broad and liberal interpretation. There, I can cite to Your Honor several other statutes that do the same thing, the statute of limitations, where this court has said that that's such a remedial portion of a statute that to relieve a party of the statute of limitations is remedial to be given broad and liberal interpretations.
All right, let me break this down a little bit. One issue is whether service by FedEx is permissible at all, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And if that is determined as a matter of interpretation of the statute, that the statute says something other than FedEx, and therefore FedEx service is not acceptable, then we don't get to any factual issues, correct?
If Your Honor finds that, no, I think what the court would have to find is that actual notice is irrelevant. It's either you must follow the certified requirement or not. And my response to that is, that's true where it's jurisdictional, but not where the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense.
Right, I understand you might not agree with these points. I'm just trying to parse them out. Number one is the statute satisfied by service through FedEx instead of certified mail?
I would suggest,
that's
yes.
Question number one. If that question is answered that it could be, so that you are not automatically out for having used FedEx, then somebody, either this court or the trial court, is going to get to an issue of whether you substantially complied with the statute, correct?
Yes.
And I understand that there are some serious arguments about how you did not, in terms of what was contained in your notice and so on and so forth, right?
I would disagree with substantial arguments, but there is an argument made by the defendant.
All right. And that would be a factual determination, right?
Yes. Well, the factual determination is whether notice was actually received. The one argument the defendant makes is that the language I used in my letter wasn't satisfactory. I believe it clearly described the medical malpractice.
So there are two factual questions. One is whether there was actual notice received, and two, whether the form of notice that you gave was complied with the statute.
The language describing the medical issues, I think.
Okay. So if you lose on either one of those three issues, then your case has to be dismissed, right?
If the court finds that service by FedEx is not satisfactory, then I would lose. If there is a factual determination that Dr. Greenspun never got that, which I think cannot be decided by this court, then I would lose. And if the court were to conclude that the description of the medical issue was inadequate, I guess I would lose also. I just can't understand how that would be. I don't think the statute requires the same definition of the medical issue that the complaint would or by an expert witness would. Right. I mean, identifying the patient and the nature of the problem, I think, is enough by the statute.
All right, you're into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use or save.
Well, I think the court has covered about everything that, in one way or another, that I would have, and I'll wait until I get back up.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Deborah Macero, and I represent Dr. Bertram Greenspun in this appeal. First, let me begin by just saying it is indeed an honor to be here before the Delaware Supreme Court today, and I just thank you for this opportunity. I'd like to start by beginning right with the heart of the matter, the notice of intent is an extension of the statute of limitations.
Wait a second. Let's get back to what we consider the heart of the matter.
The interlocutory.
Why did you file a motion?
Honestly, because I didn't know that that was the way to do it. And as I was preparing the response, it screamed at me that this was interlocutory in nature, and I honestly didn't know that that was the way to do it. So it was my error. I still believe it is interlocutory in nature in terms of it, the decision was not as against the party, and procedurally, plaintiff has not gone forward correctly. However, I would like to address some of his arguments, if I may.
Go ahead.
Okay. The notice of intent is an extension, as I said, of the statute of limitations. And because statute of limitations are strictly construed in Delaware, therefore, this notice of intent requirement must be strictly construed. The plain meaning of the notice of intent statute is that the notice must be sent, certified mail, return, receipt, requested. Pursuant to the statute, plaintiff can toll the 2-year medical malpractice statute of limitations for up to 90 days if plaintiff comports with the following requirements of the statute. First, it must be sent certified mail, return receipt requested, to the defendant's regular place of business. It must also include the name of the defendant or defendants, the name of the potential plaintiff, and give a brief description of the issue being investigated by plaintiff's counsel.
Let me interrupt you. If we forget about the content of the notice that has to be given, just focus on FedEx versus certified mail, what's the problem with FedEx?
The problem with FedEx is that it is not notice according pursuant to the statute. The statute requires...
Okay. I'm not talking about the statute. I'm saying tell me what is less reliable, less informative, less something than certified mail.
I reviewed the three tracking systems, and essentially what I see as the difference is that with FedEx, it requires an affirmative act to obtain the return receipt requested. In other words, if something is sent certified mail or registered mail, the green card comes back automatically, and plaintiff will, or whoever sends it, will have that receipt. However, with Federal Express, there is a tracking number, and the person sending is required, in order to obtain an actual receipt that it was received, the person sending must either call FedEx or go online and follow that tracking number.
Okay, stop. Let's get to the real world here. You can do something on a computer or print it out, and if you do it on a computer, you don't have a piece of paper, but all you have to do is print it out, and then you have a piece of paper. So I'm not really that interested in what you could or couldn't do. I'm interested in the level of reliability, number one, and number two, the level of information that one would have by pursuing the notice in one format or another, assuming that the plaintiff wanted to get full information that they had given notice.
Exactly. And through using all three methods, the primary difference, as I said, would be the affirmative act to actually pursue getting that receipt.
Stop. If what you're acknowledging, which I think is probably unassailable, is that FedEx is as reliable and provides the same level of proof if you need it, why should we construe the statute as restricting to only one method of reliable notice as opposed to an alternative?
I would say because the statute must be strictly construed, because it's an extension of the statute of limitations. Furthermore, because of the history of... Yes, Your Honor?
All right. Well, you're saying it has to be statutory. It has to be strictly construed because both the statute of limitations and any extension thereof are jurisdictional.
Especially this particular extension thereof. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, if the statute itself isn't jurisdictional, there's no reason why an extension of it would be jurisdictional, is there? I mean, don't you have to start with the statute that's part of the Medical Malpractice Act?
Yes, Your Honor.
And analyze whether or not that's jurisdictional?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it?
Yes, Your Honor. And
why?
Actually, I would say that the statutes of limitations in Delaware are generally, because they're in derogation of the common law, are generally considered jurisdictional.
Not so. Not so. It's a waivable affirmative defense in many cases.
True,
and the problem is in finding what is the bright line that separates those statutes of limitation that are jurisdictional from those that aren't. One bright line that's been suggested is that if the statute that creates the cause of action has a built-in statute of limitations, then that's jurisdictional. That is, you don't have a cause of action unless you file your lawsuit within a specified time. But where the statute of limitations is a general statute of limitations found in Title 10, that usually is, we usually don't have a jurisdictional problem. So where does that get us here?
Well, I believe another focus of the court would be the legislative history of 6856 in terms of the Medical Malpractice Act of 1976. When it was passed, the preamble states that it was a complete break from the, because in the past, Title 10, the general statute of limitations, was applicable to medical malpractice actions. But 6856 represents a complete break from that statute of limitations. It was completely different and limiting in nature. The Supreme Court has recognized that in several cases in Ewing versus Beck. And in
Does the medical malpractice statute contain a built-in two-year limitations period, or is that derived from outside of the statute?
It's from the medical malpractice statute, section 6856, with three very limited exceptions. The first limited exception is an inherently unknowable, and that is extended for 3 years, up to 3 years. The second is tolling up to the age of 6 years old, neither of which are applicable in this case. And obviously the third is this notice of intent statute. So it is within the medical malpractice. And this statute, I would also submit, itself is also should also be strictly construed because of the legislative history of this particular statute.
Is it the intent of the General Assembly to give an additional 90 days if proper notice is given?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And let's assume that Mr. Aper had video cameras rolling of him personally delivering this proper notice with all the right content to Dr. Greenspun, conclusively showing that there was actual notice given within the time period. Why wouldn't that satisfy the intent of the General Assembly?
Because it would not be following the statute strictly, and it would not comport with the terms of the statute.
And so that their intent is to emphasize form over substance?
Well, their intent is for the statute to be strictly interpreted. And the reason is because it is a limiting statute and not a remedial statute in nature. And the reason I say that is because plaintiff in his reply brief brings up the argument that this statute is remedial in nature, which before I get to that, I would like to raise the issue that that was not raised in plaintiff's opening brief, the argument that this is remedial in nature. That is the first time that that was raised. And I would like to address it here today, but I just need a little bit of leeway. I may cite to a case or two that might not be in my brief, but certainly there are cases that this court is aware of because they are Supreme Court cases. But the point being that this statute is not remedial. The statute began initially as House Bill 182, and House Bill 182 had the affidavit of merit requirement. As well, it also had the abolishment of joint and several liability, caps on non-economic damages in medical malpractice actions, and also periodic payments of jury awards in medical malpractice cases. This was taken to the legislature. The legislature had presentations from both sides, the Delaware Trial Lawyers Association, the doctors, and the legislature said, go to committee, work this out, come out with a compromise, because there were such differing views on this. The compromise was what you have before you today, House Bill 310. House Bill 310 had the affidavit of merit, again, the same, but then this notice of intent. This was the caps on non-economic damages, that was thrown out, so was abolishment of joint and several liability, and so was periodic payment of jury awards. That was all taken out In its place was this notice of intent. Now, plaintiff points out the synopsis in his reply brief, but I want to point out to your honors that he only points out paragraph or sentence one of the synopsis. I would like to read for you the entire synopsis that is in the reply brief exhibit number one. I'd like to read this for your honors. It begins, and this is what plaintiff cites, additionally, a process to allow up to 90 days to investigate a potential negligence claim is added and would extend the medical malpractice statute of limitations accordingly. The second sentence that plaintiff leaves out is, it is expected that this grace period will give plaintiffs an opportunity to determine whether a potential claim has merit and will result in some lawsuits that might otherwise be filed not being filed. So it was actually limiting in nature in the hopes that less lawsuits would be filed. So therefore, our argument is, again, that even if you go past the plain meaning of the statute, certified mail, return receipt requested, even if you go past that and you look to the legislative intent, you'll find that it still should be strictly interpreted.
Well, they also had an intent to allow a meritorious lawsuit. Otherwise, they wouldn't grant the extension.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't it just an issue of if there's actual notice that the manner of the notice is not controlling?
Because this is an extension of the statute of limitations, and again, I go back to my argument that it must be strictly construed.
Regardless of the intent of the General Assembly?
Well, with the intent of the General Assembly, because it's an unambiguous term within the statute. So with the intent of the people through the General Assembly, it's an unambiguous term that we argue is not remedial in nature and should be strictly construed. And with regard, again, back to plaintiff's argument regarding the remedial in nature, plaintiff compares it with the savings statute. And the savings statute has a completely different premise in terms of the lawsuit has already been filed and the savings statute saves that acts to save that lawsuit, whereas here we have a preemptive prior to the lawsuit being filed. This notice of intent letter is sent. It reserves the right for plaintiff to file the lawsuit, and so it's a completely different premise. And additionally, plaintiff cites 8118, again, the savings statute, to say that to make a comparison with this statute. However, the stated purpose of that statute is that it is remedial in nature and it should be liberally construed. At least the case law has interpreted it such. Additionally, plaintiff pointed out the case in Ohio, Marshall versus Ortega. And that case is not persuasive here because that statute is not similar to the statute that we have here. In Ohio, first of all, this court will look to legislation in other states if perhaps our legislation is based on that or vice versa. But in this instance, that statute is 180-day extension of a one-year statute of limitations. Plaintiff can mail a letter a certain way to the defendant and let them know, and it has to be sent a certain way. And it's an entirely different premise than the statute of limitations or the notice of intent, and additionally, it doesn't have the same history that the notice of intent has here in Delaware. We believe that this court can make its decision based on the pleadings and on plaintiff's disregard of the clear, unambiguous terms of the statute, which is an extension of the medical malpractice statute of limitations for 90 days, and it must be strictly construed. Just as the court below found it dispositive that plaintiff had completely disregarded this term, so should this court. And additionally, even if this court were to say that that first letter made it to Dr. Greenspun, that first letter, as I indicated in my brief, it contained a date for the medical malpractice. Now, the statute does not require that plaintiff put a date for the medical malpractice in the letter. However, by doing that, plaintiff narrowed the time frame for the doctor to do an investigation based on this date that was provided in the letter. Plaintiff, sometime after he sent the letter, realized that this was a problem, and plaintiff sent a second letter. The second letter Now, this is uncontested. The second letter was sent by U.S. Postal Mail, and it was sent sometime thereafter. We don't know when. And the second letter had the correct date. So I would submit that even if that first letter, even if you look at it as, okay, notice Dr. Greenspun received the notice, it was still not adequate or sufficient to meet with the terms of the statute because it did not have that brief description, and notice has to be meaningful, and it was not meaningful notice.
Well, the plaintiff is still a patient of Dr. Greenspun.
Exactly. And so, therefore, the point being that there is an ongoing relationship, and the date, the incorrect date, it could have been any time because there is an ongoing relationship. Up until recently, there has been an ongoing relationship. And that is precise.
Plaintiff's no longer a patient?
Up until very recently, up until the shortly after the lawsuit, yes, Your Honor, after he filed the lawsuit.
It's difficult to continue with litigation.
Yes, Your Honor. The statutory requirement to send a notice of intent via certified mail is not a mere formality. The purpose is that defendant receives proper notice of the claim within the statutory time period in order to avoid the prejudice to defendant of having to defend a stale claim. It's the same reason for the statute of limitations, which is strictly construed. The prejudice is presumed whether it is one day or one year. The statute of limitations is an arbitrary deadline, and that prejudice is presumed based on the deadline that the legislature has set. The statute of limitations does not discriminate between a just and an unjust claim. The statute of limitations and the notice of intent extension represents legislative and public policy controlling the rights of potential litigants. And in balancing these rights, the legislature placed the pivotal point at precisely 2 years with a limited exception, three very limited exceptions, and this one is a 90-day extension if plaintiff complies with the statute. A late filing is not a timely filing, and the trial court does not have the judicial discretion to alter, change, or lessen the statutory limits for commencement of actions. Thus, the defendant asks that this court enforce the unambiguous terms and the plain meaning of the statute that plaintiff must send the notice of intent certified mail return receipt requested. However, even if this court should choose to look to the legislative intent, this court will find that a strict interpretation is proper. And since the statute is not remedial in nature, and since from its inception, 6856 has been a limiting statute, it would not be consistent with the statutory scheme to permit plaintiff to disregard this term of the statute.
Isn't it at least remedial in the sense that it was intended to remedy the hasty filing of lawsuits by my lawyer gets the patient coming in the day before the statute runs and has no opportunity to investigate? It's remedial in that sense, isn't it?
No, in terms of the remedial normally I think of there's a problem that maybe plaintiff created by filing something and then that has to be remedied. And the remedial in nature part of a statute would be to be able to correct that. And this is not viewing it that way in terms of it's a preemptive notice that plaintiff must file before the lawsuit to or must send to defendant to let defendant know about the lawsuit. And really it's hoped that a good investigation will show that the lawsuit may not be and will limit the lawsuits, that there will be less medical malpractice lawsuits.
And so, thereby make the system better. Right?
Exactly.
That's not remedial?
Exactly. Overall, yes, Your Honor. And thus, our final argument is that this court should affirm the Superior Court's granting of Dr. Greenspun's motion to dismiss. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
One thing that I did not address to the court, and I think it's important, and I admit it's not in the record, but the way this case arose was just as Justice Ridgely suggested. This man came to me about 3 or 4 weeks before the statute ran, and when the notice was sent out, I sent out 8 letters because I didn't know what, I had looked through the record I had, I didn't know what doctors were doing which. The suit was filed against three entities, and one was later dismissed. And so you don't understand, this was not done casually by using Federal Express. The statute is unclear And as you compare the statute sort of to Rule 15A, the statute's unclear whether the notice has to be received by the doctor before the two-year limitation runs. And in my mind, when I looked at the statute, I said, I want to make sure these people get it. And the notice was sent out on April 22nd. The statute of limitations for the first defendant, the one who I eventually dismissed, Dr. Sartor, would have run on April 25th. So I did not accidentally send it by Federal Express. I chose to use Federal Express because I wanted to make sure the people got the notice before the statute of limitations ran, as the receipt shows they did. With regards to whether or not this statute is remedial or not of the 90-day provision, remember that House Bill 310 was added to the medical malpractice statute after it had been in existence for many years. And as the synopsis, it was added to extend the statute of limitation period further. That's the very definition of remedial statute. If you compare this to the statute such as 18 Del C, Section 3914, that's a statute that says that an insurer having notice of a claim who fails to notify the plaintiff of a statute of limitations is told until that notice is given. That extends the statute of limitation until notice is given, and that is routinely referred to as remedial and to be viewed expansively and liberally. And to me, the 90-day rule is the same way. So since the statute of limitation is an affirmative defense, an attempt was made to give the doctor notice, and we don't know factually whether there actually was or was not notice. I would say if the court does not reverse the Superior Court's decision, at a very minimum, it should remand it for further factual determination as to whether or not the doctor did get the notice. Thank you, Your
Honor. The court will take this matter under advisement and take a brief recess.